My name is Judy Bauman. I was born here in Fairbanks and raised in Delta, so I've never really been in a village or lived in a village. Don't understand the culture that a lot of natives have grew up with, and I feel like I've lost a lot of my heritage. What I would have to do now to get a lot of that back is to study and to go out into a village and live a subsistence lifestyle. I'm wondering if I would be able to do that today. My father had applied for allotment for me and for my brother when we were, I guess you had to be 12 years old before you could even apply. And I must have been about 12 and my brother about 13, and he helped my mother fill out paperwork for her allotment. And he filled it out for, you had to be living on the land or using the land subsistently before you could even apply. And so we had been picking berries and whatnot as children down around Delta. So my dad had applied for the land down there in our names. Well, we never got title to that land, and I would like to live subsistence in hunting moose and fishing, and my husband is an excellent hunter. But I don't want to live on that land down there that I applied on. I don't know if there's any way you could apply for a different acreage than, you know, where we applied for. It wasn't really where there's any fish or game. It's mostly just berry picking type ground. And right now, how subsistence, I'd like to live where there's moose and there's fish and that type of thing. And I since I didn't get any title to the land from that allotment, I'd like to check into applying or changing my application to some other area. But I suppose when you applied for it, you had to do it on the land that you were living on at the time. So I don't know if that is possible. Also, because of the state had put the land that we had applied on, the state had put a protest against the land because it was right next to the public highway. And I guess BLM didn't approve. Every time there was a protest, they would kind of hold off and wouldn't do anything with that particular application. And the Alyeska Pipeline put a protest on that land because they thought they might need to go through there with an access road to the pipeline, so they put a protest on it. Talking about, you know, the people living in the Pioneer's home, I was really upset to hear what they had to write in the newspaper about that too. My grandpa worked on a steamboat for many years up in Tenna area, and my grandma and grandpa live in the Pioneer home now, and I was over there talking to them, and they absolutely hate it over there. My grandma says that's not her home. You know, her home is not there. That's the white people's home. They don't have the kind of food. She's 84 years old, and she didn't grow up eating that kind of food and having people come in there and bother her stuff, make her bed, wash her clothes. Up until November of this year, you know, she's still baking bread for my grandpa, and my grandpa wouldn't eat anyone else's cooking but hers. He insisted that she bake the bread. He didn't want to have anyone else bake the bread, and they don't care for the food over there. They don't care for, you know, just sitting there all day waiting for a family to come visit. And to them, it's not home. My grandma said she got married when she was 16 in 1916. And ever since they were married, my grandpa's always provided a place for her to stay. And to her, this is not something that he provided for her. It's not her home. She doesn't want to be there. I told her I would bring some things from her house, some of her pictures and stuff to put up on the wall, and she said, no, this isn't my home. I don't want anything in here. And right now, because of different complications in the family, they end up having to move out of their home. Their home was being sold. This was not Alaska Native allotment land or anything like that. It was what they had purchased themselves. But they don't have any place to go. They don't have, I don't even know if they had applied for their allotment. And so I don't know. If I talk to them, sometimes they don't understand what you're talking about anyway. And my grandma says, don't, I asked her to come here and talk and testify. And she says, no, I don't want to make waves. You know, what they've done, I can't say anything about it. She says, Judy, don't even mention my name. I don't want to have anything to do with that. Just like when at the nursing home now, she has to have eye drops put in her eyes, and they have a specific time that they will do that. And sometimes the nurse doesn't come right away, and if I'm there, I'll tell her, I'll call the nurse for you. No, don't call the nurse. If she don't come, that's okay. Don't worry about it. She doesn't want to bother anybody. And she said the other day, she was saying that she's never told anybody what to do. She said as long as she's been married to my grandpa, she's never bossed him around and told him what to do. And my uncle had married a non-Native woman, and the problems that came up in the family with them having to move out of their house and whatnot, she's blaming it on this woman. She says it's because my uncle listened to her. She would tell him things, and she listened to her, and she says, that's not our ways. Natives don't do that. I'm also concerned about the children, especially the ones that were born after 1971. I have two girls, and one was born in 69 and one was born in 81. One daughter is considered Native and eligible for the land claims, and the other one is not. And I don't like that. To me, it's almost like discriminating against your own people. They're still, to me, they're both my children and they're both Natives, and it's very difficult for me to think that they're being treated differently. For as far as preserving our heritage and culture, I really believe that the people themselves are going to have to take it upon themselves to do that, like with how Howard Luke was talking about the classes that he's giving up at the university, teaching the younger generation about subsistence, how to build traps and live off the land the way he was raised to do. The way I was actually raised being white. I was raised in Delta. There were no other Natives in the community. I thought of myself as being white. When I went up to the University of Alaska in 68, the students, Native students from the villages, would call me Gusuk. They, to them, I was white, and I was not Native. And I, talking with one woman here today who's attending the university, really it brought out in my mind that it was not only their feeling, but it was also my feeling that I was white. And I guess I portrayed that to them. You know, I felt the same way. And I feel like I've really lost out on my culture and my heritage. And up until just recently, I've never really wanted to really understand what it was to live in a village and to be raised the way the Natives have been. And I would like to do that, and I would like to see my children do that. My oldest daughter stayed in Minto with a missionary family up there to go to correspondence school for 1 year, and she absolutely loved it. She goes, Mom, let's move to the village. You know, let's live in the village. And I would like to see where we could live subsistence. You know, my husband being non-native, and me being not the head of the house, being the native, I don't know how that would work out, being able to live subsistence lifestyle. I know when all of us kids were born here in Fairbanks, if you were a native man married to a non-native woman and you had medical care taken care of for your children, but if you were a non-native man with a native wife, then he had to pay for the medical care. And my dad had to pay to, when we were born, the hospital had to pay to get us out of the hospital. They still talk about the time they didn't have much money to get my sister out of the hospital. And she was just a baby. They had to come up with $300 or something before they could take her home. Well, if it was a native man, they wouldn't have had that problem. Now my mother can go to the native clinic. At that time, I guess she couldn't. But now she can go, and all the kids can go. One thing that was brought up the other day that really struck me was how the natives treat their usage of living off the land. They use everything. If they shoot a moose, they use every single piece of that. Even the head, they'll boil it up and make soup. I mean, they don't waste anything at all. And yesterday after the meeting, my husband and I had gone out to have a pizza, and we walked into the back room, and here on the table was more than half a pizza just left. You know, just wasteful. And the natives don't do that with it. When they take a moose, if it's for their own use or for a potlatch or for, you know, anything, they use every bit of it. They're not wasteful in that. I talking about living off the land and being able to provide for your family from the land. I know my husband is not native, but he's a very good hunter. As long as he's been up in Alaska, he's never eaten beef. You know, he's never eaten any kind of meat from the store. He's hunted and got his meat. And if there is anyone that he knows that needs meat, he's willing to share, you know, that game with them. And I would like to see the natives who are living a subsistence lifestyle not be so controlled that they could have, you have to have a moose permit, one person can get one moose. Like some of the older people who cannot go out hunting anymore, someone needs to take care of them, and I don't think it should be the government. That's not the way they lived long ago. The people would take care of their own people. And my husband has gone out in the last couple years and taken my daughter with him so they could get two moose. And our family cannot eat two moose in 1 year, but we give it all away. We give it to people who cannot hunt. And I would like to, you know, years ago, and I had to read this up at the university in one of their books when I was making a report for one of my classes one time. In villages where they would have what you would consider almost famine, and they'd have sometimes one man who was a really good hunter, and it was almost his responsibility to feed the whole village. And he would, you know, they didn't have all the sophisticated kind of rifles and whatnot like they did when the Americans came here to be able to go out hunting. They had to do it, I don't know how they did it, with bow and arrow or harpoon or whatever. They had to go out and get the big game that way. And sometimes when the hunting was scarce, it would take a real good hunter to be able to get any game, and he would provide for the whole village. And now to say you have a village with a bunch of people there and only a few people are going out hunting, and yet everyone needs to eat, I don't think they should limit, you know, one moose to one person. I would like to see, as far as education, for the native, I'd like to see more things that are going on, like with Howard Luke being able to teach classes where the younger generation and people like me who did not have the opportunity to live subsistence be able to learn how to do that. I'd like to see more than just, you know, one person, if they could use the elders as a resource for teaching the younger, you know, kids how to do different things. I remember when I was young, I don't know how old I was, 10 years old or something, my great uncle came to live with us for about a year. He was 96 years old. And he asked my mother, "What would you like me to make for you?" And she said, "I'd like a dog sled." And he went outside and chopped some trees down and took them back. And I don't know, he didn't use any kind of electrical tools or anything. He didn't even use an electric drill. He showed me how he made it with a stick with a nail on the end of it and a little bowl, and he put it in his mouth and he moved that bowl and it would drill a hole. He made everything that he worked on that sled with, he made everything that he used from nothing. I mean, he could go out, 96 years old, he could go out in the woods and he could make whatever he wanted to. He didn't have to go to the store and buy anything. And that sled today is really, there's so many people trying to buy it off my mother. People down in Delta, non-natives, have tried to copy that sled time and time again, and they can't do it. They have the sled right there. They look at it, they can see what's holding it together, and they can't make a sled like that. You know, you can't pass that on just by looking at it. You know, you have to learn how to do that. And I would like to see some of these older people, their knowledge and the ways that they grew up passed on to the younger generation. I know with my grandma and grandpa, they have been exploited in a way by non-natives for many years. They did Eskimo dancing for Alaska Airlines all over the world, in Japan and Paris and Canada and Australia and New York City and Seattle and all over. They did Eskimo dancing, and at one time, some company made a record of their songs that they used and acknowledged them on the record with their name, that they were singing the songs, and sold the records and made money on it with no rights to my grandparents. And my grandpa really feels like he was really exploited in that area, and some of the things that he could teach us and pass on to us, some of the old stories and his singing and, you know, their songs and stuff, he won't do it. He won't do it even for family. We've wanted to record some of the stories, things that happened in his life, and just with family, with my mom and dad and us kids would go over there and we'd take a tape recorder, and he says, "No, I won't do it. I won't. I'll tell it to you, but you turn the tape recorder off." And I really feel like we're being, you know, cheated in a way. We're losing some of that heritage that maybe I could have had. I think that not only education for the Native people, going back to the culture and the heritage and learning about that. I know some of the, well, all the people that come from the villages, they, a lot of people have that already, but people that don't have that, or in the younger generation, a lot of them don't even care or want to be identified. Like my oldest daughter now, she thought she would love to live in the village. Oh, move to the village, no, build a house there. But when you really talk about it, she doesn't want to be identified as being a Native. To her, she's, you know, she doesn't consider herself to be Native, although she's three-quarters Eskimo and I'm only half, you know. But it's the way I imagine I brought her up, because of the way I was brought up, and it's almost instilled in you. But not only should we learn the Native traditions and culture, and but also like the language. Here one lady was talking about teaching bilingual language in school, and even in a village now they learn their native tongue as a second language, where English is first. And when they first had schools, whether it was, well, not in a village to begin with, but like in Mount Edgecombe or something where my mother went, their native language is what they learned to speak at home, and they learned the second language is English. And now they've got that turned around. I know if my native language, in order for me to speak it, somebody else will have to teach me at school. My grandma's tried to teach me a few words here and there, and she'll laugh because I can't pronounce them right. But not only should we learn that type of things, but also if we're to get along in the world today, be able to understand the system that has been set up by the federal government, we're going to have to get another kind of education, you know, college, where not only can we understand what it is to live in a village, but if we're going to be dealing with the corporate structure that's already set up and expected to live in that, we're going to have an education that will enable us to, you know, get along in that area. Just like up until now, I'm just beginning to understand a little bit about what Alaska Native land claims is about. I'd like to understand more how the federal government has dealt with the Indians and in the states, and then look at how they're dealing with the natives in Alaska. And one fellow had talked about that at our corporation meeting, and I talked with him afterwards, and he said, well, you need to understand thoroughly Title 25 of the U.S. Code, and that deals with all the Indians, and read and understand Title 43, which has to do with the lands. And so I went down to the library and got those titles out, and it was like Greek to me. I mean, it was little pieces of paragraphs here and there, and try to put it all together. I don't understand how to do that. I'd like to go to school and understand how to read law and how to look it up and how to, you know, how they write it and that type of thing. I think that's all I have for now.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you decided to speak tonight, Ms. Bowman. Well, I'm glad we convened our meeting tonight. even though we realized not many would likely be coming, since most spoke during the day on Wednesday and Thursday and again today. If there's anyone else who would like to speak tonight, though, we'd like to hear you. We'll be convening again tomorrow at 10 o'clock for the last time. We'll just have a meeting here tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, and that'll be our last meeting in Fairbanks. But if there's anyone else who would like to speak tonight, we're in business, and we're going to Nenana on Sunday and then to Tanacross Monday. Yes, sir. Yes, please do.
My name is Larry Peterson from Fort Yukon, and I'm just curious. I'm at. I know that the Native people or the Indian people in the United States has been one of the most studied group in the whole world, and now I see another study going on here. Now, with all this information that's being compiled, I'd like to know what's going to be done with it. Is there anything positive going to come out of it? Or is it that just people come up here and just tell all their problems?
Well, that's a good question. This really isn't a study. It's the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, which is an international organization of Eskimos from Alaska and Canada and Greenland, asked me to come and to go around the state and hear the views that Alaska Natives wanted to express in each region about land claims, about ANCSA, about 1991, about sovereignty. The World Council of Indigenous People, which is an international organization of Indians, is also sponsoring this commission. But it isn't to study Native people. It's for Native people to speak and to express their views on these things. I'm going to compile a report. It'll be available, made public next year, and it will be for the purpose of enabling Alaska Natives to decide for themselves what directions they want to go in the future. So the Native organizations that asked me to do this had in mind that it was an opportunity for Alaska Natives to speak, not simply to have somebody come and look at them under a microscope.
All right, I was just curious because I wasn't quite sure exactly, you know, what the whole aspect of the thing would, you know, come out to be. I'll give you a little background about the experience I have had. First of all, I stated I was born and raised in Fort Yukon, and I did go to school at Mount Edgecombe. I was a city council member. I got interested in the politics of the thing. Then I went on and became president of the Native Association up there, which is an IRA council at that time. And then the land claims started up, and I became very active in that. And I also been vice president 10 of chiefs about three times. Then from there I went on and became a state representative. And then working for Natives all my life, and I've had a lot of mixed feelings exactly, you know, what I really am in a way, which I am a Native, but I've been labeled by other people as no, you're not Native, yeah, you are Native, or, you know, you're in between, because I've went through this type of experience, and I've lived most of my life in the villages, but I also can exist in the urban areas, which is hard for a lot of the people that I work with, you know, that try to come into the urban areas in which to hold a job and work and different other things. So I'm caught kind of in between, and it kind of bothers me, like, in a way, and I've had a lot of people turn around and downgrade, like Mount Edgecombe, you know, sending students a long distance away. I disagree with sending, you know, children, like in grade school, you know, to long distance. But I think for high school students, I think it's an opportunity in which they can get and start looking at other things other than just one small community, which to me, like when I grew up, I was considered, I was a spoiled brat, because I didn't know anything, the basic things about even, washing clothes, making your own bed, and different other things like this. When I went to Mount Edgecombe, Mom and Dad was not there. And I had to do it. So as my education starts expanding, and I start thinking about, everybody's talking about subsistence. It's the way of life to a lot of the villages. And I start having second thoughts that how long is subsistence really going to last? I mean, who's going to educate a moose or what animal in that area as they stay within this range which they can be hunted? There are things which I see. I love the moose and ducks and geese and so forth and different other things myself. But I start getting mixed feelings exactly, what's really going to happen to the younger people. The young lady here mentioned, that she's had one child born, before 1971, one after that, one is eligible and one isn't. But as I start looking at it, eventually the one that's born after is going to be eligible anyway, because as far as stocks being transferred, after the family dies or so forth, that part, to me is not really the great important thing. And I start looking at 1991. Hang on to this stock. But I have mixed feelings about that too. I think that if an individual has stock, he has a right in which to sell if he wants to sell. And I don't think that the regional corporation should dictate to tell somebody whether they could sell or not sell. And whether we want to face the facts or not, some of the corporations are going to belly up. And if they can't sell their stocks, then what is the land claims for? That means an individual that has stock that's worthless, that can't do nothing with it. In sitting and listening to quite a few different meetings and different other gatherings and so forth, I kind of get totally confused exactly what our roles are. There are people said that the land claims, as far as corporations go, is not the route to go. That the individual people should get the land, which I think is great and fine. Except if you don't have some type of way of bringing in money, in which eventually that the state and federal is going to start taxing that land, and if you don't have some way of bringing in money, and if you do distribute it all out, then they're going to lose it. Now, where the media is going to be, I don't know exactly what the solution is going to be. And there are a lot of problems. There are a lot of problems within the villages with alcohol, with drugs. Those things have to be looked at. And there are a lot of federal and state funding that goes into these programs. And yet I don't see any positive action that come out of any of this stuff. Also, that as I sit and listen, and most times I don't do very much talking, because I'm a very good listener, and I sit back and see and start thinking about some of these problems that is happening, and it's happening very fast. When the land claims was passed, a lot of the people in the villages didn't even know what a corporation was. And a lot of them still don't know what a corporation is. And a lot of them don't know all the terminologies of what a stockholder is, what a proxy vote holder is, and many other things that goes along with corporation. And when a land claims was passed, we ran into a lot of problems as far as we're not like a corporation like IT&T or the big corporations, AT&T and so forth, that every individual there owns an equal share of stock, where these larger corporations, people do have control of the majority of the stock, which we don't have here in our corporation. Of course, the state law had to be amended in which to work within the corporate law. And that was kind of a hassle, which did pass through the state legislature, but it did pass. And as far as seeing what's in the future and seeing, you know, whether the land claims is the best solution or not, it probably wasn't, but it was a start in which to deal with some of the things. And if anybody has ever studied and looked through the land claims and start saying, you know, what we were going to get, and it turned out a lot more, because the several governors that we had wanted to only give 12 million acres of land, and we ended up with 40 million acres of land. But that's due to a lot of other things, whether we want to admit it or not. A lot of it is geared to the oil company itself at the time and the energy crisis. Because when the oil fields was, they said, discovered up in Prudhoe Bay, at the time they said it was, it wasn't, because they knew about it back in 1902. They call it the Navy Petroleum Reserve. But at the time it wasn't feasible expense-wise to get it out, because it would cost too much money. And as the fuel shortage came greater and greater and greater, then there was a big push switch to get it. And at the time, also the land claims was being pushed. And it went hand in hand, and we came out, you know, I'd say fairly well. Probably wasn't the best deal, but it was better than nothing. And as time goes on, and I start seeing things that has happened, a lot of the village corporations started businesses and learning in their mistakes and different other things, and some of them lost in businesses. And it may have been better if they just stuck the money into a trust fund and just draw interest. And for a while, their interest rates was pretty good. They're up to about 18%. But as time changes, some different things happen. And I see the problems that are going on, but I don't really see what you call a true solution, because each village is different, but their basic needs are the same. And we have a really kind of a unique situation where we have a lot of villages that are very remote with not very many people, and we have a large city in the state that has practically about half the population. And then when we deal with government, especially the state government, as far as the needs in the villages, I say they're getting, you know, shorthanded. But then again, you can turn the thing around and say, well, if half the population is in a larger urban area, then they should get more funding. So it's a kind of a two-way street here, where you can see one thing and say, well, this is not right, and you look at another way and say it is right. So what is right? That I can't answer, but it bothers me. But being raised in a small village, I could see a lot of the problems that are there, and I can see a lot of fears and concerns, because all of a sudden with the land claims, and you start looking at the news media, which isn't the best or the greatest friend of a lot of people, comes out and states a great huge amount of sum of money. And where's all this money going? What is happening to it? And we haven't even addressed the land, because some of the villages haven't even gotten their land yet, titled to it. And we're over halfway through the Land Claim Settlement Act, and they don't have title to their lands yet. Then we start thinking about, well, what's going to happen when all of a sudden the state is running out of oil revenues, and they're looking at the native corporations and their land base as a tax basis. And there's already been legislation that have been trying to push through the state legislature in which to do this. But fortunately, it did fail, but it's still there. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if that does pass in the near future, when the corporation themselves are still trying to get to stand on their own 2 feet. There are so many things that I can't foresee yet. These are just some of the basic problems that we're looking at. There are more stumbling blocks that we're going to run into further down the line that we haven't even addressed yet. And some of the major things that we're looking at now is how to protect that land. Now, what if somebody crashes on that land? Are we liable for suit? Which I think we are by law. What if somebody starts a fire there? Are we the ones that are going to have to pay to put that out? And what if it goes out of our area into state or federal land? Then are we liable for paying for that? These are some of the issues that bothers me and scares me, because they haven't been really addressed. And each time we have meetings and different other things, I see a lot of things that are going on that kind of disturbs me in a way, that are being overlooked and not being addressed. And I guess some of you are saying, well, why don't you say something about it? I do. I do talk to the leaders. Not like in a meeting, you know, get up and say things, but I do kind of drop the hint and say, hey, you know, what's going to happen when this comes about? They really don't have any answers. These are some things, you know, that are still down the line, but they're coming up awfully fast. And there are so many things that are happening, and our leaders are being spread so thin right now that they can't cover all these things. And they have to attend all these meetings that are being held. Good God, how much money is it going to cost to go to these things? The expenses are great, but they're also important. These are some of the things that have bothered me, that I lost some sleep about, staying up at nights thinking about it, seeing if I can come up with some kind of solution. But I haven't really come up with any solutions. I can see a lot of the problems. And I think that's just about all that I really have right now in which to say. But I did appreciate the young lady there that stated, as far as subsistence hunting go, that everything is utilized and used. And when she went to the pizza parlor there and seen all the food that's being wasted. In the villages, people are very conservative. They are—they may not be jack of all trades. No, they are not master of all trades, but you know, jack of all trades, or whatever, however that's worded. Because in a village, you're in a different situation. You can't call up a carpenter and say, "Hey, come fix my house." They fix it themselves. Their motor breaks down, they fix it themselves. Or anything that happens within the villages, they do themselves. They work on it, they fix it, and different other things. And when people turn around and start saying people in the villages, you know, are not educated. That's not true. I'd like to see some of these congressmen and different other statesmen and so forth that makes all the decisions come out there and try to live and see if they can survive, see what their education is going to do for them out there, instead of sit there with their $250 suit on and make decisions that they don't even know nothing about. Thank you very much.
Just before you go, Mr. Peterson, I do want to thank you for that thoughtful presentation. You mentioned one thing that I'd like to ask you about. You said that there was a move in the state legislature to have a state property tax on land throughout the state imposed. Did you say that?
Yes. The person that started that was a Fairbank legislator by the name of Charlie Parr. In fact, they had hearings in Fort Yukon.
What year was it that
that was back in 75, 76, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you.
My name is Philip Pinatak, and I live here in Fairbanks. And I have before me a couple of articles that I would like to present to the commission to make copies, because I'm aware that information received from the commission will be recorded and documented for public reading and in libraries. Would that be possible, Mr. Bridger?
Yep.
Okay. Well, just to mention that these two articles I have is, okay, one of them is a statement by William Paul to the AFN Board of Directors. Statement was made in October 1971. It was during the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. And the other one I have is a memorandum, which is a historical document that have been restrained from dissemination by the U.S. administration, because this memorandum relates to the treaty session, and the treaty session is the foundation of Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And this memorandum relates to how the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was established. And this is dated back November 21, 1867, and it's from Mr. Clay to Mr. Seward. And, well, I sure would appreciate it if these were recorded and written down, because I want to let those that delve in the report of the commission to read these and let them judge for themselves. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll read them myself, and then they'll become part of the commission's record, permanent record, and that will be deposited and available at the University of Alaska Library here in Fairbanks.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, I didn't think we would have many customers this evening, but it's turned into a very interesting evening. And I want to thank all of you who came and all of you who spoke. I'm especially glad that Mr. Cruikshank spoke. I heard him speak at the elders' lunch today, and I invited him down to tell us something of the history of Alaska with that in mind. Yes, sir.
I just maybe say a few things now, but I'll talk more when you have a meeting in Nenana. That's where I'm from. I'm Gilbert Kessler. And first off, I no way like the corporation setup they have. That they're taxable in there. I mean, as payment for the land claims, I mean, they're like giving you a leaky bucket of water or something, you're trying to hold, plug all the holes or something. Maybe sell the stock in 1991 and taxation and whatnot. I think there should be some other way, but I don't really know what the best way is. I didn't get involved in the land claims till probably 78. I spent probably close to 30 years here in Fairbanks and working. And when I thought, everything was peaches and cream till I got next to our corporation. And I'll speak more on it later, but I mean, I'll maybe give you the history in our, in my history, what I see, how our corporation went, but it's, right now we're kind of teetering right on the, we have to be very careful because all our money was frittered away because we were Indiana was in an unfortunate position of being on a railroad and highway, and they could jump right into business. And some of the other isolated villages were forced to invest their money. And they were better off than we are now. Of course, we were probably about one of the three bigger villages. But our problems there at Nenana is kind of unique because it's, when we first started, it was a first-class city, but now it's a home rule charter. But Nenana is dominated by a white population. It's maybe about 50-50, but, and it's real hard to deal with. We really don't have any land within the boundaries of the city, and we're really having a hassle to secure some 3E lands, which is government, that was never utilized by the government, federal, FAA and the railroad. And our regional, that's not, they stand to benefit from the subsurface, and they give us no help on that. And we, even our, like our congressmen, we get no help from them. We get more help from other representatives from other states rather than our own. And we have quite a hassle with our state government. And I'm not sure, but I think there's just about at least three villages. Dillingham and Cordova are both probably have the same problems. And I just have a thought on that subsistence. I think a lot of our problems would be on subsistence, the opposition to it would be down if the legislature would do away with big game guides I think they're the chief instigator behind, against, and just to maybe make the Fish and Wildlife Enforcement Agents guides at a salary and let the state take the money. And I haven't really thought about what I have more to say on it when you have your meeting in Nenana, but I know other villages are fritted the money away, that they're in bad shape. I don't know, they I think we should. I don't know if the IRA traditional council or should turn all of the land to them, or I really don't know what the, you know, know this, what the, as far as I can see, that the corporation has only benefited a small group that's around us, around the corporation, and the average shareholder, I mean, that the poor Indian sitting along the river there, all he got is a whole bunch of animosity. I think everybody thinks he's got two or three Cadillacs, and even our regional here is took a little longer than our village corporation to go, because they were bigger. They when the land claims money quit coming in, they really went downhill. I can't see where our president of Doyen should get over $100,000 a year. I think even if as dumb as I am, I could do a better job than he can, because we had a kind of a hassle in our corporation, and we kind of booted out most of the old management. And it's the way to go. I mean, it's that, well, I'll say more to you when you talk about
it. Thank you, Mr. Kessler. Well, we've had a wide variety of views these last 3 days, and I sure appreciate it. I think that we'll adjourn, if no one else wishes to speak, until tomorrow morning at 10, when we'll have our final session, and then we'll have a meeting at Nenana on Sunday afternoon, and then one at 10 across on Monday afternoon. And by then, we should be much wiser. Yes, ma'am.
I just want to make a few brief comments. I'm an attorney with Alaska Legal Services, and I'd like to express some problems that clients have brought to us, especially the elderly and the disabled who are on fixed government incomes. And I don't know if this problem has been brought up before.
Could we have your name?
My name's Judy Bush.
Thanks.
And our clients are in the situation sometimes of receiving dividends for their corporation, and when they do that, then their benefits from the government are cut back. So they are in a situation of receiving what they're due under the Settlement Act and losing it within a few months by having overpayments in their Social Security programs.